Omaha Public Radio presents another program from the Durham Museum Lecture Series on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by Elaine Nelson, Associate Professor of History at the University of Nebraska at Omaha. She'll speak on the topic Buffalo Bill, Performance, and Selling the American West. Dr. Nelson is a United States historian specializing in the North American West. Her scholarship takes into consideration the complicated relationships that formed between the people and places in the Intermountain West and Great Plains. Her first full-length monograph is a revised manuscript of her dissertation, Dreams and Dust in the Black Hills, Indigenous People, Promised Lands, and National Identity in America, 1868 to 1968. This study considers how the role of the tourism industry exploited indigenous cultures, land, and gender to showcase a myth that celebrated Western expansion and national identity. Dr. Nelson's talk is part of From Nebraska to the World, Buffalo Bill's Wild West exhibit, which will be on display at the Durham Museum through May 1st. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, February 23rd, 2016, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the Durham Museum, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Tim Hantula, Director of Exhibit Design for the Durham Museum.
Tonight's presentation, Buffalo Bill, Indigenous Performers and Selling the American West, examines the captivating role that Buffalo Bill's Wild West had in shaping the world's perception of the American West. Our presenter tonight is Dr. Elaine Marie Nelson, an assistant professor of history at the University of Nebraska at Omaha. Dr. Nelson teaches courses on the American West, Native American, and women's history. Her published work has appeared in the Great Plains Quarterly, and her first book, Dreams and Dust in the Black Hills, Indigenous People and Tourism in the American West, is being published by the University of Oklahoma Press. She graduated with her Bachelor of Arts in Education from the University of Nebraska at Kearney in 2002, and from the University of Nebraska-Lincoln with her Master's in History in 2004. Her Ph.D. in U.S. Western and Comparative Indigenous History was earned in 2011 from the University of New Mexico. The Durham Museum's exhibit, From Nebraska to the World, Buffalo Bill's Wild West, is sponsored by the Douglas County Commissioners, Mutual of Omaha, and the Durham Society, with media support from KETV. The exhibit is part of Westward O, a year-long citywide celebration of the American West. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Dr. Elaine Marie Nelson.
Thank you. Good evening. I'd like to thank Tim for that very warm welcome. Thank you to Tim and the wonderful staff here at the Durham Museum for inviting me here tonight. I especially want to recognize Jill Bruckner, Carrie Meyer, Jessica Brummer, Kim, Sarah, the rest of the education staff for helping facilitate the lecture this evening. In 1885, arena announcer Frank Richmond climbed to the top of a wooden platform and asked a crowd of 20,000 people for their silence and attention. After careful instructions and a brief pause, a cowboy band offered a spirited version of the Star-Spangled Banner. And almost immediately, hundreds of Native Americans, cowboys, vaqueros, and others on horseback filled the open-air stage. The crowd cheered excitedly. The air smelled of gunpowder, animals, and dirt. Colorful costumes swirled around the dust-filled arena. The applause rose to a deafening level and drowned the sonic booms of blank cartridges and horse hooves pounding on the earth. And then, there he was, adorned in an embroidered magenta hunting shirt and a white sombrero. Buffalo Bill Cody rushed to the center of the group. He responded to the cheers. With his long hair flying in the breeze, he tipped his hat, bowed, and said, "Ladies and gentlemen, let me introduce you to the equestrian portion of the Wild West exhibition." The sound of his voice resulted in thunderous applause and cheers. They loved him, and he knew it. Government servant, king of all men, frontier hero, first worldwide celebrity, Avenger of Custer, Chief Scout for the U.S. Army, Most Famous American, and Guardian of White American Supremacy, etc. What, if anything, can I add to all of these different titles? Fascinating might be the one word to describe William F. Cody. Born in 1846, he was a child of the Iowa and Kansas frontier. He became a writer for the Pony Express, a trapper, a Civil War soldier, buffalo hunter, cavalry scout, and fought against Native Americans. At the age of 23, he was a famous dime novel hero. And at 26, he starred in his own New York theater drama. 10 years later, Cody created the most successful Wild West show to tour the world. By 1900, over 1 billion words had been published about him. His life overlapped with the Civil War and decades of territorial expansion in the United States, two of the most pivotal moments in American history. Cody's generation witnessed massive changes in technology, transportation, territorial boundaries, and social reform. He both celebrated and participated in these many transitions. But this time, more than any other, also marked decades of violent encounters between various groups all over the country. Chinese race riots happened in the West and the Pacific Northwest, lynching and abuse of African Americans and former slaves in the South. Political unrest between immigrant groups in the Northeast and the Midwest flared up, and the reprehensible labor practices toward people of Mexican descent in California and the Southwest persisted. The populations that experienced the most concentrated damage in the late 1800s, however, were Native Americans. They lost thousands of lives to warfare and disease, in addition to the dispossession and suppression of their land, culture, and freedom. The darkness of this chapter in U.S. history serves as a foundational period for understanding a region we know as the American West. Yet the majority of people at the time of Cody's generation viewed these decades as celebratory badges of honor to mark the conquest that was simply part of the country's destiny. No matter their interpretations, these events definitely played a role in how William F. Cody transitioned from a Civil War veteran and a buffalo hunter into the dime novel hero and stage character, Buffalo Bill. Much like the interpretation of historical events on the frontier, Cody's real life and mythic persona became intimately intertwined. Tonight, I'm going to talk about how Cody utilized myth and the art of storytelling to sell an idea of the American West, an idea that continues to persist today. I will explore this by looking through the lens of performance, Cody's own performance, of course, and that of the massive cast who worked on the Wild West traveling exhibition. Now, before I dive into all of that, it would probably be helpful to explain this place called the American West. There are a lot of different ways to define it, and I'm sure you all have your own definitions. How do you define it as a place? For example, where does it start and where does it end? I have an ongoing debate with my husband, a Missourian and also a Western historian. He swears that the West starts in Missouri. I don't really think so. And I'm from South Dakota, so I know a little bit about where the West might start. Then there are people who believe it starts in Rocky Mountains, like all of my friends who never leave Colorado. Does the West extend into Mexico? Well, it certainly did at one time. What about Canada? Absolutely. The establishment of international borders remained in flux, and that turns this dialogue into an interesting exchange. Is California part of the West? Of course. But what about Alaska? And then you must consider that the West cannot be designated by direction. Like for the Chinese, who arrived in large numbers during the California Gold Rush, for them, the American West was east. For Mexican populations, it was north. Indigenous people in North America did not necessarily recognize this place as the West. It wasn't west of anywhere. It was simply their home. These considerations are amusing to explore, as they are to consider, and I love having these discussions with my students in class. I believe they reveal more about the American West than just its placement on a map. The West is an idea, or as it exists in our imaginations, has much to say about how we understand its place in American history. Now, a lot of people are responsible for shaping our views of the West, historians, scholars, literary people, filmmakers, but I argue that William Cody, through his character Buffalo Bill Cody, played the greatest role in defining the American West as an idea. And he did this through the powerful tool of performance, drawing on romanticized versions of certain people, events, and places of the past. Cody became the most famous and the most influential storyteller of the American West. Cody's Wild West exhibit promoted the West around the country and the world for 3 decades. He hit over 1,000 U.S. and Canadian cities, and he traveled through 12 European countries. He drew on his experiences in Western territories and later his theatrical performances to inform his creation of the most successful Wild West show to exist. And during Cody's tenure, there were about 100 different Wild West shows that were traveling all over the country, but his was the most important. Each season, it included a cast and crew of between 700 and 1,700 people. They loaded themselves onto 2 to 3 trains of 50 or more cars each, along with 400 horses, 20 buffalo, dozens of elk, donkeys, deer, mules, and Texas longhorns, numerous stagecoaches, costumes, tents, food, weapons, props, rope, instruments, grandstand seating for at least 20,000, and their own traveling fire department. In all, there are estimates that it cost about $4,000 per day to operate the show. If you are thinking this sounds a little bit like a circus, you would be correct. But Cody was adamant that his Wild West was not a circus. Rather, he believed it was educational and based on realistic portrayals of historic events. I will return to these claims of authentic and realistic, but first, if Cody declared an educational value for his show, what did he want to educate his audiences about? In an interview conducted in 1892, he reminisced on the reasons for starting the Wild West. He said, "My longing for the wild and exciting life of the Far West returned to me, and knowing that the days of such a life in reality had passed away, I determined to organize the company to represent it and show the people of the East what life in the Far West had been." Cody desperately believed that his version of the West, buffalo hunts, scouting, trapping, horseback riding, and encounters with Native Americans, would disappear if he did not somehow preserve them. He viewed himself as an ambassador of historic preservation for Eastern populations who only knew about the West from newspapers and popular dime novels. So he continued in his interview to say, "I proceeded to collect Indians, cowboys, scouts, trappers, buffalo, and perform the West as a realistic representation. It was," he claimed, "a decided success from the start. My initial performance spread like wildfire." Cody was anything but humble. Cody's show was indeed a success. There is no doubt that this was due in large part to his stage presence and the convincing performances of his diverse and varied cast. The Wild West gave thousands of shows between 1883 and 1913. In 1899, for example, Cody, his cast and crew traveled over 11,000 miles. They performed 341 shows in 132 cities in just under 200 days. Much to the excitement of crowds in New York, Baltimore, Richmond, Washington, D.C., Nashville, Indianapolis, Cincinnati, Boston, and Philadelphia, and a whole host of smaller towns. It wasn't just the big urban centers. He went all over the place. The Wild West started with an extensive parade down the major city streets. It included the diverse cast of Native Americans, cowboys, Arab performers, Annie Oakley, Mexicans and people of Mexican descent, Russian Cossacks, Irish Lancers, stagecoaches, and soldiers from France, Germany, and America. Journalists favored the spectacle. One of them noted, "It was as if the wild regions of the West had mustered all their queerest denizens clothed in holiday dress and sent them forth to the East." The parade served as a teaser for the actual show. This was, of course, a tactic to sell more tickets. Crowds waited in lines for hours, despite the expense of attendance for a typical working-class family. With adult and children's tickets at 50 cents and 25 cents, respectively, the cost for a family to attend the Wild West could be at least $2. Add food, programs, souvenirs, and beverages to this, and the expenses start to pile up quickly. Now, that doesn't sound like a lot to us today, but in the 1890s, $2 could cost a week's worth of groceries and other necessary household supplies. The combination of posters, flyers, and the parade itself proved to be an effective advertising campaign. After seeing the parade, children begged their parents and tried to harass them into letting them attend Cody's show. Sound familiar to anyone out here? These adults were also easily persuaded by newspaper coverage. Most reporters claimed that there was an urgency for people to see Cody's exhibit. It was, like he claimed, educational and realistic and genuinely American. These are his words. They warned the public that those who skipped the show might never be able to see anything like it again because the people and animals living in the plains were quickly vanishing and would become extinct. This cautious tale drove hundreds of thousands of people to purchase Wild West tickets each summer. There they witnessed the performance of their much-beloved characters. One of them was the King of Cowboys. This was William Levi Buck Taylor. He was a crowd favorite in the early Wild West tours for his horsemanship and roping skills. Now, Buck Taylor exhibited, quote, great strength, nerve, endurance, and skill. But more than anything, newspapers noted that he looked the part. He was, quote, striking, handsome, tall, and a man among men. In reality, he was actually a cowboy. Before he joined the Wild West tour as an employee, he herded cattle from Texas to the Cody Ranch in North Platte, Nebraska. Buck Taylor's life, like all cowboys at the time, was one of very hard labor. But once he stepped into the arena, he shed his work clothes and displayed a brightly paired shirt and a handkerchief along with an embroidered hat. He was a sensation, and he set the standard for how audiences thought cowboys should look and act. In all reality, most Americans knew very little about cowboys and cowboy cultures, especially those in the East. They actually didn't much care for them. They viewed them as distrustful, immoral, and violent low lives. But Cody's cowboy performers flipped those stereotypes on their heads. Their performances of horse trickery, bronco riding, and roping skills, things that you see in rodeo today, they actually learned largely from Mexican vaqueros. And they placed them in high regard. The audiences placed cowboys in high regard as they improved their image over time. But within a few years, creative imaginations saw cowboys as romantic heroes who ushered civilization into the supposed wild frontier lands. They quickly became essential to Cody's dramatization of the frontier and pioneer history. Men, women, boys, and girls cheered as characters like Buck Taylor, Billy Bullock, and Bronco Bill Irving performed acts of bravery by riding at full speed across the arena stage. These cowboys stole people's hearts. It is important to remember, however, that Buck Taylor set a standard for later cowboys who joined the show. Real working cowboys, plucked off ranches like those in western Nebraska, turned into performing showmen. Although the early tours included cowboys who were African American and of mixed indigenous and Mexican descent, populations that were indeed a large part of the demographic of real cowboys in the West, the Wild West exhibit cowboys evolved to reflect Buck Taylor's look, handsome, tall, and white. Cody believed that this is what audiences wanted. Now, despite the preference to hire white cowboys and to separate racial and ethnic groups within the show itself, Cody's show was still the most diverse one out there. He employed hundreds of Native Americans. He also recruited Russian Cossacks, Mexican and Mexican Americans, Cubans, Hawaiians, Filipinos, and Japanese, French, German, and Arab people to perform alongside an ethnic mixture of men and women of varied European and Euro-American ancestry. It is important to note that the cast was not segregated from each other behind the scenes. Many white men were married to Native American women and had mixed-race children who traveled with the show. Cody and his publicists were not always comfortable answering questions about interracial families in the cast, so they created a PR spin, something we would call a PR spin today, and turned the white men into cultural mediators who were respected, they said, by both Native and non-Native communities. Through Cody's performance and storytelling, the creation of a mythic drama far outweighed the portrayal of a realistic American West. And Bronco Bill Irving was married to Ellie Irving. She's a Lakota woman, and their son traveled with the show. Despite this diversity, Cody's Wild West left out important populations that represented both urban centers and rural landscapes throughout the American West. Chinese performers were notably absent, even though many Chinese people toured with other shows at the time, and African American cast members were few and far between. A diverse spectrum of women were also absent from the cast. With a few exceptions, Native and Mexican American women were relegated to props and backgrounds in village scenes. The exceptions for women: sharpshooters and trick riders. The most famous woman to tour with Cody's Wild West was Phoebe Ann Moses, but you probably recognize her more as Annie Oakley. Moses, or Oakley, was not a Westerner by Cody's definition, probably not by mine either, because she was from Ohio. But her skills represented what he sought from both male and female cast members, the mastery of a so-called Western activity or sport, such as shooting or horse tricks. Born as the fifth child of a mother who was twice widowed, Oakley was a natural with guns from a young age. Her family's survival depended partially on her hunting success. She was so good that the meat that they didn't use, she was able to sell and make extra money for the family. Oakley improved with age. At 4'11", she was a remarkable shot and found ways to use her skills as public entertainment. This eventually drew her to Cody's Wild West show. It was pure, wholesome entertainment, in her opinion. Oakley's casting in the Wild West was a bit of a happy accident. She auditioned in 1884, but was turned down because the show already had a sharpshooter. It was a man. In a twist of fate, he fell ill the following year, and she re-auditioned. The show manager, Nate Salisbury, was so impressed with her genuine talent that he offered her the job on the spot. Much of the shooting acts from the era were a mix of artful deception. A lot of them used magic tricks to sort of flaunt that they were good shooters. But she was the real thing. She was an exception, and the Wild West cast knew it, and they respected her skills. She shot clay pigeons and stationary targets in the show better than any other cast member. Such a performance from a short, petite woman surprised audiences. She broke their assumptions that firearm expertise was purely a male trait. While she performed this typically masculine skill, she also performed her femininity. She took careful aim to make her entrances graceful, even pretty. One reporter noted, she never walked. She tripped smoothly in, bowing, waving, and wafting kisses. Known almost overnight as the Little Sure Shot, she wore dresses both on and off the Wild West stage. Now, she looked, by all appearances, to be a proper lady. But when she started shooting, she shocked audiences. Women especially screamed at fright at her rapid skill to flawlessly transition from a woman into what they thought, someone doing male things. Oakley's capabilities won her many admirers. Who could not love her? According to one publicist, she was a modest little girl who shoots like a man. Buffalo Bill Cody knew he had a novelty act on his hands, and he was going to cultivate this, because this is all about selling the American West. He did not hire her out of any desire or obligation to make the Wild West show any more inclusive for women. But once she was hired, he knew that the show could benefit from the performances of other white women. Even though it was rare for the show's management to advertise any single cast member, Oakley received her own publicity posters and her own flyers. This encouraged other women to join the show. And over the years, these included Lillian Smith, who was also a sharpshooter from California, and some trick riders, Della Farrell and Georgia Duffy. Their participation was never more than 10% of the cast, but they did earn their own place in the Wild West souvenir program. Every year with the tour, Cody put out a souvenir program. It had the history of Indians and cowboys and women, and eventually there crept in a little small section on women in the West. And this is what it said. The Real Cowgirl is a development of the stock-raising West when compared with The Bachelor Girl and The Independent Woman of the East. She is not of the new woman class, not of the sort that discards her feminine attributes, simply a lively, athletic young woman with a superfluity of nerve and animal spirits, with a realization that in affairs where skill is the chief qualification, she has an equal chance with her brothers. All the cowgirls can rope with horse running at top speed, swing gracefully from the saddle, and pick a fallen handkerchief off from the ground, mount and subdue bucking horses, and use gun or pistol with a nonchalance and proficiency of the most expert cowpuncher. They are the sauciest, happiest, loveliest assemblage of femininity that ever galloped gleefully around the arena or appeared in a street parade. You who see them will agree. This was probably also a publicity stunt to introduce women to audiences who were interested. Although women's performances received considerable attention while on tour, they posed somewhat of a challenge to Cody's Western drama. How did women fit into Cody's story of the West? Now, he was a supporter of women's suffrage, but he held little to no regard for the roles that women played in Western expansion. This also holds true for minority women, for African American women, Chinese women, Mexican American women, and Native American communities. For Cody, women existed in the separate sphere of domesticity. They were in the home. He was happy to have them on board to tour, but there wasn't really a clear place for them in the storyline about that duel that he liked to talk about between civilization and savagery. Now, Miss Annie Oakley had a very different view. As the highest paid cast member on tour, second only to Buffalo Bill Cody himself, she viewed her performance as an opportunity. As her popularity grew, she made it her second career to teach other women how to use guns, not only for sport, but how to defend themselves. She believed women should learn how to handle guns just as well as they handled babies. It is estimated that over the course of her life, she taught 15,000 women how to properly use a gun. Cody's cowboys were the most popular. Annie Oakley was the most beloved. But there is absolutely no doubt that the participation of hundreds of Native Americans made Cody's Wild West a long-standing success. Cody was an astute showman, and he recognized their vital importance in his dramatization of the West. In his mind, after all, Native nations represented what he called the savage wildness of the West that American progress was fighting to tame and civilize. This portrayal of them is terribly problematic, yet they became the most important characters in his storytelling performance. And from his point of view, you can't really have American progress unless you have someone to overcome. So for Cody and his performance, Native Americans were those obstacles for Americans to overcome in the sort of conquest of the American West. Cody realized early on from his theatrical career in the 1870s that indigenous characters captivated audiences both on stage and off. Before the advent of Wild West shows in the 1880s, 1870s, Native peoples from numerous tribal nations earned money to conduct mock buffalo hunts, war dances, powwows, and other short performances all over the country, from Niagara Falls to here in Nebraska at Fort Robinson. By the 1860s, a lot of them were Indian scouts who entered the entertainment industry of theater. As a result of their popularity, Cody stopped using supers. Supers were white extras who dressed as Native Americans and performed Native American roles on stage. So he stopped using supers and shifted his attention to the process of hiring actual Native Americans to perform Native American roles. The result of his pursuit certainly impacted his theatrical shows, as it allowed him to edge out his competitors. But more importantly, Cody's employment of indigenous people this early on made him appear to have strong relationships with Native Americans from his time on the frontier, when in fact, he did not. In reality, Cody knew very few indigenous people until after his Wild West exhibit gained popularity in the late 1880s. The Lakota men that he invited to stage in 1877 only joined his production through the recruitment efforts of a mutual acquaintance who happened to be married to a Lakota woman. But this small act of hiring Native actors instantly enhanced Cody's performance as a true, authentic hero of the Western frontier. In addition to this rise in credibility, Cody's use of Native Americans started to edge out other entertainment venues who continued to rely on the white supers, the white extras. This had the added impact of his ability to successfully market and sell the American West to Eastern as well as European audiences. By the late 1880s, Cody recruited Native American cast members almost exclusively from the Pine Ridge Reservation, today in South Dakota, but then it was still Dakota Territory. It is important to note, however, that these Native men, women, and children were paid employees. They signed contracts through the reservation agency. Sometimes there is this misconception that Native Americans were happy to just serve as performers for the show on a volunteer basis. But like all traveling exhibitions and Western shows, Cody's indigenous cast was paid for their time spent on each season's tour. The process of employing Native Americans sounds like it might be simple, but it was not. Cody or the show manager, Nate Salisbury, could not just go to the Pine Ridge Reservation and hand out employment contracts. In order to secure members of tribal nations for their show, they had to pursue permission from the Office of Indian Affairs, known today as the Bureau of Indian Affairs. The Office of Indian Affairs commonly resisted such requests from traveling show exhibitors. But why? Reasons for this have to do a lot with U.S. federal Indian policies from the time. Now, the 1870s marked the beginning of a systematic project or process known as sort of a civilization project of Native Americans. Known on the federal level as assimilation, this project included major policies dealing with land reassignment, boarding school education for Native children, and training in the practice of agriculture. At the same time that the U.S. government forcefully encouraged new ways of life, they vehemently restricted all aspects of tribal practices, which included hunting, Native languages, traveling, dancing, singing, gathering, clothing, etc. Even religious practices were outlawed on most reservations. If Native peoples violated any aspect of these policies, like trying to hide their children or speak their own language, they could face severe punishment, prison, or have their rations and annuities withheld for extended periods of time. According to the government officials, this multi-tiered project would ultimately civilize indigenous people in the ways of mainstream white Americans. Now, this was their word, civilize. Indigenous people in the ways of white America. Needless to say, assimilation resulted in emotional and physical trauma, as well as devastating losses of land, children, and tribal traditions. Contemporary indigenous nations are still trying to heal from the decades of these atrocities. In light of these massive changes placed on Native communities, the Office of Indian Affairs was not necessarily receptive to requests to hire Native peoples to dress, speak, sing, and dance in traveling shows. Such behavior, they claimed, worked against every aspect of federal assimilation policy. The Office of Indian Affairs commissioner claimed that it kept them from their agricultural pursuits and encouraged the practice of their traditional ways, which was what the government wanted them to get away from. In 1890, the Pine Ridge Reservation agent reported that the Wild West show business was a, quote, growing evil of permitting Indians to be taken from the reservation for show purposes. The injury already done is irreparable and will prove a curse to these people for many generations to come. Regardless of these concerns, the Office of Indian Affairs complied with such requests. As long as Cody paid a security bond of up to $10,000, transportation costs, and food and medical care, the agency superintendent would give permission to certain Native peoples to join his show. Once established as a reputable traveling company, Cody's Wild West casting requests were always approved. He never had any problems hiring Native people from the Pine Ridge Reservation. Cody certainly benefited from this process. He knew that Native Americans and the Lakota Nation in particular would spark immediate excitement in the exhibit. He needed them, and they became the touchstone of his packed arenas. The public's fascination with them never diminished. A man named Winston Roche recalled attending the Wild West and seeing Indians for the first time. Buffalo Bill was my childhood hero, he said. When I heard he was coming and my dad said he was going to take me to see Buffalo Bill and some real Indians, well, that was amazing. He remembered cheering on the cowboys and the cavalry during the show. In the crowd, he said, we were living our fantasies and imaginations, living them as part of the show. Cody's most popular native performer was Sitting Bull, who joined the tour in 1885. Even though government agents claimed that Sitting Bull was not allowed to leave the reservation, Cody was persistent. He charmingly persuaded officials to allow the famous Lakota leader to join his show. This was not necessarily an emotional plea. It was a business decision. He said, if we can manage to get him, he said this to Nate Salisbury, if we can manage to get him, our everlasting fortune is made. Crowds loudly and repeatedly cheered for Sitting Bull whenever he rode into the arena on his horse. Some believed he was more popular than Cody, an issue that may have sparked jealousy from the show's leader. Sitting Bull actually negotiated a remarkable hiring package for himself. He earned $50 a week, received a $150 signing bonus, and earned extra income from selling his photograph and autographs to the public. Cody's use of Native Americans in the Wild West cast them in severely limited ways. They appeared in over half of the acts on the program. There were about 20 acts on the program, and they tended to go between 9 and 10 is what they would appear in. They attended in all of these acts, some of them in which they danced and sang and rode in horse contests. But in the majority of their scenes, they continually performed repetitive roles as the attackers, villains, and antagonists in Cody's story. They killed Custer and his men at Custer's last stand and attacked innocent pioneers in the Deadwood stagecoach scene. Nearly every performance ended with the climatic attack on settlers' cabin, in which Native Americans approached a settler family and viciously attacked them, only to be then counterattacked by Cody, the army, and cowboys who swooped in heroically to save the day. None of these episodes were particularly accurate or reflected any kind of context for the audiences. And despite the flawed interpretations, the scenes gained mass appeal, especially because in the end, Cody and the cavalry always triumphed. These scenes were exemplary of what Cody called, quote, savage resistance against the heroic deeds and patriotic devotion to the advancement of American progress. Now that's from one of his souvenir programs. Here, the printed word was just as powerful as the show's living images. Cody's souvenir program was updated each year to reflect changes in the cast, but the rhetoric of each section rarely changed. In them, Cody lamented about the passing of the American Indian. There seems to be, Cody's program read, no power on earth, he said, to save the departed red man. His doom seems to be fixed. His day on earth is apparently short. All seem to agree that his is slowly, surely going, passing from our gaze forever. This lamenting was a marketing campaign as well as part of his own storytelling. Cody wrote, it will prove profitable to see these leaders of a dying people, for that day may be far distant when they have passed away, and will have missed your chance. In the Wild West exhibit, so clearly exploited, the historical realities of Native Americans for profitable gain, then why, you are probably asking, would they agree to work for Cody? The answer to this is layered and very complex. Many indigenous people later talked about their reasons for working as show Indians. There were claims that it was good employment, it paid well, and it offered a temporary escape from the dire, impoverished, and restricted reservation conditions. One Lakota man named Rocky Bear said that the shows were the way that I get money. I saved this money to buy some clothes for my children and family. Another Lakota man named Blackheart pointed out that he was raised on horseback, he said, that this is the way we had to work as a kid, and that Cody's show furnished us with the same kind of work we were raised to do. This is the reason we want to work with these kind of men. He continued that if white men have the privilege to work any place and earn money, then Native people should be able to do this as well. Another letter from another Lakota man, Chief Irontail, from Pine Ridge, he wrote to the Pine Ridge agent, that he had experienced very good treatment. He said, "I will now write a few lines to let you know we are getting along nice with the show. Good food and clothing and everything. We are all fat and healthy because we are under good care. Keep in mind that most of the people, especially in the Pine Ridge Reservation, at this point in time were facing starving conditions." Native male performers earned anywhere between $25 to $50 a month. This is why Sitting Bull's $50 per week rate was pretty high. Depending on their roles, if they were cast as a chief, they might make $50. If they were just a regular warrior, they would make about $25. Native women earned about $10 a month, in addition to selling their art and beadwork to the show's attendees. The fact that Cody both allowed and welcomed Indigenous families to tour together was an incentive for some. For example, it might mean that their children, if they were away on a Wild West show, did not have to attend boarding school that year. Other Native Americans believed it was an opportunity to see and learn different things. Lakota holy man Nicholas Black Elk, for example, said he joined the show because "I wanted to see the great water, the great world, and learn the ways of the white men." He said, "If the white man's ways were better, as they were telling him on the reservation, then he would be more convinced to live that way when he returned home." There were also instances where Native American leaders used the tour as an excuse to travel to the nation's capital of Washington, D.C., where they could politically argue for the plight of their people's diminishing conditions back home. This happened usually every year. Wild West performers experienced a greater degree of freedom while on tour. They traveled without passes. They came and went from their camps. They danced and sang, both on stage and off. They were allowed to speak their languages. They freely socialized with each other and among other cast members, and were allowed to wear the clothing of their choice, except, of course, in the arena, where they were expected to wear traditional regalia. In some instances, if the food was not to their liking, they made it clear. On one occasion, they boycotted the kitchen until they and other cast members received better meals. Whatever their reasons, Native peoples were not forced to work on the Wild West circuit. And if they tried the show for a few weeks and they disliked it, they always had the right to request to return home. Rocky Bear mentioned, another Lakota man, "If the show did not suit me, I would not remain any longer." With a few exceptions, Cody and Salisbury always made sure they were paid for their work and provided them with a ticket to return home. Sadly, there were documented deaths of Native people who toured with Cody, if you read the exhibit placards, as well as numerous instances of illness that were recorded. And these, of course, created controversy between the Wild West Show and the government and Native people themselves. Nicholas Black Elk's traveling experiences were mixed. He enjoyed what he called the Indian parts of the show, such as the dances and the horse races, but he disliked getting paid to perform, or he liked getting paid to perform brave deeds, but he did not much care about the white people's parts. That's what he called them. One scholar concluded that Black Elk disliked the fact that he and his people were always defeated in one way or another. Yet the young man found himself homesick on several occasions and ended up feeling alone on the earth in what he was doing. So he returned home, and as he said, he carried with him lots of stories to tell his family and community. It is important to understand that Native performers were not dupes. They weren't sellouts. They weren't fakes. You might draw conclusions that they used their employment with Cody's Wild West as a way to subtly fight back against the severe restrictions that they faced at home. They knew the Office of Indian Affairs was strongly against this kind of work. So several Native people viewed their participation as a way to resist government policies aimed to destroy their cultures. Cody preyed on his audience's willingness to crave nostalgia. It's nostalgia about Native people and nostalgia about the American West. The American West, or what they imagined the American West to be, was disappearing. This was his argument. This pulled on the public's heartstrings as they lamented such a loss. It was also this chapter of frontier history, they believed, that made America so exceptional from the rest of the world. This idea of exceptionalism was clarified earlier on by a historian named Frederick Jackson Turner. In 1893, at the Chicago World's Fair, Columbian Exposition, he delivered what became a prolific statement on American character, progress, and democracy. In an essay titled The Significance of the Frontier in American History, Turner argued that the frontier had vanished, but that the closing of this chapter produced an exceptional country in America. The frontier, he claimed, was a process of rugged individualism and pioneer strength to overcome and conquer the, quote, savagery of the West. In Turner's story, like Cody's story, Native Americans symbolized this idea of savagery, while Americans symbolized civilization. Now, while Turner delivered his speech to a crowd of about 100 historians, Cody performed a similar storyline to thousands of people on his Wild West Arena grounds located near the Chicago Fairgrounds. He didn't perform at the fair. He performed on grounds close to the fair. Both men remained influential placeholders in the telling and retelling of Western history. But there was another important speech delivered at the fair, and one that gets very little recognition. Simon Pokagon of the Potawatomi Nation delivered the Red Man's Rebuke, or the Red Man's Greeting. His words challenged Turner, Cody, and others to reconsider the so-called line between savagery and civilization. On behalf of my people, he said, the American Indians, I hereby declare to you that we have no spirit to celebrate with you the Great Columbian Fair now being held in the Chicago city. No cheer of sympathy is given to us, but in answer to our complaints, we are told the triumphal march of the Eastern race westward is termed the survival of the fittest. And so we stand upon the seashore, chained hand and foot, while the incoming tide of the great ocean of civilization rises slowly but surely to overwhelm us. Even though Pokagon's speech was the most widely circulated statement of its kind delivered by a Native tribal citizen at the time, his point of view was often overlooked. The story of the West continued, and continues today, to be mostly dominated by the intellectual insight of Turner and the skilled storytelling and imagery of Cody. Their most flawed prediction was the disappearance of Native cultures and indigenous peoples. These nations continue to persist, and like Simon Pokagon, they offer an important and critical reproach to Turner's and Cody's views of the conquest and civilization of the American West. William F. Cody left a significant legacy across the world. Over the course of his show career, he became his show character, Buffalo Bill. He truly believed that his life was representative of the frontier experience, and that he exemplified the men who stood between the so-called lines of savagery and civilization. Up until his death, about 100 years ago in 1916, he continued to defend his traveling exhibit as an authentic display of Western life. He remained steadfast in his position that the purpose of the Wild West was to entertain while educating the spectator. As a profitable enterprise, he showed the world romantic ideas about who and what existed in the American West. And 100 years later, we are still thinking, considering, debating, critiquing, and talking about this legacy. But here is when it's important to think about history as stories of the past. History is told different ways by different people. Cody's stories were not accurate and not at all completely authentic. You could say the same thing about Cody himself, as he became the actual myth that his storytelling perpetuated. But this was the history of people, events, and places that he created for himself and performed for his audiences. To him, it wasn't a show. It was real life. Thank you.
You've been listening to a program from the Durham Museum Lecture Series on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Elaine Nelson, Associate Professor of History at the University of Nebraska at Omaha. She spoke on the topic, Buffalo Bill, Performance and Selling the American West. Dr. Nelson's talk is part of From Nebraska to the World, Buffalo Bill's Wild West exhibit, which will be on display at the Durham Museum through May 1st. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, February 23, 2016, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Jessica Brummer, Director of Marketing and Public Relations at the Durham Museum, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 600 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.